I'm gonna close this door and have people come out downstairs.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for having me again. I enjoy coming to the Rush County Group. My name's Joan Hostetler, and I want to introduce the man behind the curtain, John Harris. He's always the one getting the equipment and getting me here and doing a lot of the behind-the-scenes work. I wanted to make sure you all know that I have this PowerPoint presentation up on Dropbox. Here's the shortened link at the bottom here. So it's bit.ly, bit.ly/2M, capital T as in Tom, PY5U. I'll leave that up just for a second. And you're welcome to tell your put this on your web page and let other people know. I'll keep this up there for quite a while. Okay, so what I'm going to be telling you about today, and I'm trying not to go over time. I hear we have just like a little over an hour or so,
we don't have to be out of here what until 3 o'clock.
Well, I won't keep you that. I won't keep you that long. When you start sleeping, I will stop. And we are going to be here till 3 scanning photographs for the Indiana album too. So if you want to go home and get something or come back, and we have a couple people coming with things. Okay, so I'm kind of wearing two hats today. I have a company called Heritage Photo and Research Services, in which that's our paid business, and we help people preserve photographs. We scan a lot of photographs for libraries and archives. We catalog a lot of images with Past Perfect and other programs, and just work with individuals on preservation of photographs. My other hat that I'm wearing today is the Indiana Album, which this grew out of our business and a need that we saw as people would come to us with old family albums. They might be excited about the portraits, but we would get excited because they would have photographs of great-great-grandma's house, and they don't care about it, but the people who live in that house now would. So organically, you know, probably over a decade ago, we just started scanning these, just building up a small digital collection. And so it has grown as we've met more people like this with photographs. We've been inspired by these, and we wanted to make them available to the public. We also have seen something with social media where there are groups like Memories of Pierston or I Grew Up in Paoli or whatever, all over the state, where people are submitting their photographs, but Facebook makes them much smaller. They're JPEGs, they compress them, they're not good enough quality to publish. So we're trying to tap into all those groups. As long as you're scanning them, send us the large scan, we can add it to the project and it'll be cataloged and searchable. So we're reaching out to all of those people. That inspired us a bit. We also reached out to the State Library Historical Society, the main groups with the statewide history focus, and nobody was really doing a project like this. They want the original photographs, but not copies, for the most part. So it's hard to say the beginning date, but last year we became a nonprofit with the Indiana Album, and we got some grants to make it real. So now we're having scanathons all over the state, where we just, like you have back here, it's pretty simple. We set up a couple scanners. We have a lot of volunteers who help us and ask people to bring in things to us. So our focus is, we can't take every portrait. I mean, if we had a sugar daddy and a lot of money, we would love to copy every genealogy photo. The Fort Wayne Library will accept any portraits that come their way, but we're focusing on photographs that we think might interest others as well. So we're looking for photos, negatives, snapshots, even maps, matchbook covers, visuals for the most part, of houses, street scenes, businesses, church images, group portraits. You'll see several examples here. Interesting people shots as well. It's sort of hard to describe. I copied a couple today because they were dressed very interesting, or it was a good photograph of several brothers, and I thought that would be neat, plus they're identified. So it's subjective. Always show us any interesting photos of people doing things. Like, for example, right now we have a request for someone remembers milking the cow and squirting the milk over to the cats. Okay, we can't find a snapshot of that, so we're looking for that. Somebody else wanted the Saturday bathing in the wash tub, and we haven't found any of those photos, but surely they're out there. So we're looking for things more general interest like that. Many, many people will use these, from students to preservationists to historians, just to people who are writing their family history. So we're getting them out, sharing them widely. We are letting people use the low-resolution scans for free for whatever project we want. I get frustrated when I want to use photographs and you can't put it on Ancestry or you can't share it on Facebook and you have to pay a fee or get a license. We're trying to do away with that. We're making these low resolution ones available to everybody. We're also finding that we might find the best photographs of Fort Wayne here in Rush County. So we're making the photographs available to any libraries, museums, or institutions that ask for the high-resolution copies. As part of the preservation plan is to make multiple copies that are out there all over the place. We're also going to give the whole collection to the Indiana State Library. I see this going at least till 2021 after the Indianapolis Bicentennial, maybe longer if we can get funding, but eventually it'll go to a repository where there'll be a backup system, a robust backup system. And so here are just some examples of a few that we've got from Rush County so far. We like doing these then and now images on our Facebook page. So here's Main Street, Rushville, from a postcard that Kevin Haar had. And here's the view as of 2014. And you can see, you know, several of the buildings are still there, but others are gone. And people really love this because it gives it context so they can see what we're talking about. Here's one that a woman, Heidi Strunk, bought some images in an auction, and she just wanted to save them. So this is the Raleigh School, in front of the Raleigh School, and it doesn't show the school, unfortunately, but what's a broader interest of this one, look at those little chair covers that have a pattern on them. And we get researching, why is this important? Well, that's a pattern that was known as Sunbonnet Sue. My grandma did quilts with these. She called it the Amish pattern, but it's really Sunbonnet Sue, and Sam has a name too. And so quilters are very interested in learning when they started using this pattern. So a lot of quilters have expressed interest in this. They don't care that it's Raleigh, but they like what is pictured. Here's another one that Kevin loaned us that, and he scanned, obviously, these himself and shared them. We don't have them all cataloged yet, but this one's a fascinating one because it's Brand's grocery store and meat market, and we've learned, and several people on Facebook submitted information. This was at 701, I think it was North Main Street. It's where it's a real estate office is there now, and a tax service. So obviously this frame building was replaced by a brick building, you know, not too long after this, maybe 20s or 30s. And the man in front is Walter West, and it was in an old newspaper article that he drove the meat wagon. And just a couple more of local. Eleanor Arnold and her family, of course, they go way, way back to the 1830s in the county. Someone in their family, her husband's family, was a photographer, an amateur photographer. So we scanned a lot of her glass negatives. This is actually in her Gothic Revival, 1850s Gothic Revival house. This is one of the Mrs. Arnolds. I need to get her name. But it's really great because it shows her stove. Students could use this to learn about interiors or cooking and kitchens, that type of thing. And here's another one from Kevin that shows the centennial of Rushville, and that was a cake that was made, and he even sent in an article that this was Glenn Ellingwood, I think it was, who had the big cake that was used for the big homecoming celebration. So anyway, we're getting these from all over the state, just really fascinating images. We also have a preservation mission. We're trying to teach everybody how to handle their photographs because, you know, people you know, touch them, and the oils, as we'll talk about, the oils are bad for them. They tape them up. They write on the back, which can bleed or which can cause embossing. Or we get a lot of people just coming in with their photos like this. You know, they're not identified. They don't know what to do with them. And believe me, young people are not into this stuff, and they're getting rid of family heirlooms. They have no clue even what a negative is. What a negative did. They're throwing away slides. They're throwing away negatives, glass negatives. So we're trying to teach people how to preserve what are now referred to as the heritage photos or the actual paper photographs, as well as the whole problem that we're having now with digital preservation. So we have a mission to teach people to scan at high enough resolution, because here's an example. This is a daguerreotype. They were made reversed like this. But the person who initially scanned it did it too low resolution. You can't see the sign on the side of this store up in Warsaw in Erleesburg, Indiana. But once it was rescanned, you can see, and it's very good detail. We're also trying to teach people how to back them up. DVDs are already on their way out. Most printers or computers don't even have a drive for that anymore. You need to at least have them backed up on two hard drives, ideally one off-site in case a tornado hits your place or you have theft or something like that, so, and even up on the cloud. Okay, so if you want to check into what we have up so far, we have 7,200 photographs cataloged so far that are on our page, which is, if you just remember our webpage, which is indianaalbum.com, it's also on the handouts here, so take this and it's at the bottom. It will lead you to our catalog, and I'll just show you real quick and get to it. How you can go into, so we're live now, you can go in and look at random images and just see a selection, see a selection of what we have, or you can do a keyword search. And does anyone have a town or place you want me to search right now?
Check out Spiceland.
Spiceland. Okay, so we have five examples so far, catalog so far, from Spiceland. Let's see, I'll just go to this one, Man on a Bridge, possibly Spiceland, Indiana. And so you can
That's
go...
That's not Spiceland.
It's not Spiceland? Okay, the problem was with this one is it is by a Spiceland photographer. See, so that's why we said probably. We didn't know. So what we do with a lot of these is we put them up on Facebook, and locals know their community much better than we, you know, or we can spend a lot of time researching. So the catalog's a work in progress. Mm-hmm. If ever you see something that you question, if you don't think it's right or you can add a date, you can always click on this Send Us Feedback. And then you can send your name, send your comments, and send it to us. And we regularly update the catalog record. My dream is to get to geotag every photograph with the longitude, latitude. We are spending a lot of time putting in the exact address. And we're talking to HistoryPin, which is a site that we can work with to, you can eventually go to a map, say of Rush County, see a dot for every place that we have represented. That's the next phase that I'm really excited about. But in the meantime, we just need to get a lot of records. Okay, so... And then we go by Library of Congress standards. We share these also with the Indiana Memory, which is a state library page that has collections from all over the state. All right, so we've been really pleased. Over 220 people have shared over 8,200 photographs. We have a little bit of a backlog, and we have lots of volunteers who are helping with. So if you'd like to help, even from home, or if you'd like to reach out to people in your community and scan them or go work with your local library, we can take those scans. And all this information is on our handout. A quick plug for our funders. We've gotten grants for this, and we hope to, like I say, keep getting grants for several more years, because there are thousands and thousands of untapped photographs, and they're being thrown away regularly. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about is how to date, identify, and a little bit about preservation. I've talked about that in the past, but I'll end with that a little bit too. Processes are the way they're made, the chemical way that photographs are made. Like if it's a tintype, it's a certain chemistry. If it's a daguerreotype or if it's a gelatin photograph, and I won't get deep into the chemistry, but just enough to help you identify some of these. I'll then get into process or formats, and those are things we're more familiar with, such as postcards or panoramic photographs. So going way back to the very beginning, cased photographs were the earliest photographs that we find in the United States. And I primarily talk about American collections. It was a little bit different in England and France, where they used paper photographs more at the beginning. But photography starts for practical purposes in 1839. And our first photographs up until about the Civil War era are usually in these small cases. So three processes are in these cases: daguerreotypes, ambrotypes, and tintypes. So what you're looking at in this case, there are two types of cases that were made. If you have one that is a pressed leather or paper, that's probably 1839-40. The earliest photographer I found in Indiana was Bloomington in 1842. So, and I don't know about Rushville, you had daguerreotypists by the 1850s, but the earliest ones were in these pressed and paper cases. In about 1854, they started making, it's really a plastic case, it's a thermoplastic or called a union case. And Carol said she brought some daguerreotypes so we
can... No, actually I misspoke, they're tintypes.
Okay, tintypes, all right. Are they in cases?
No.
Okay, all right. Well, I didn't bring any, but I'll show you what they look like. When the photograph itself would have been put behind a mat, it had a piece of glass on top of it, and those were taped together. And then after a certain time period, they started putting them in a little decorative brass preserver frame, and they were popped into this case. So they're little book-like cases. And here's another exploded view of them. If you're lucky, you might find writing on the back there. Sometimes people find, what I love is when you find a piece of fabric that the person in the image is wearing. So, you know, there are all sorts of things, a locket of hair, stamps, notes, that type of thing. It's recommended that you not take this apart yourself and don't ever attempt to clean these because you can really ruin them, and I've seen some horror cases. So the first process to be found in the case is called a daguerreotype, named for a Frenchman who came up with this process, which he gave freely to the world except England in 1839. France and England weren't getting along very well. But so in the late 1839, early 1840s, we started seeing these daguerreotypes made. They vary in size from a whole plate is about 6.5 to 8.5 inches. A half plate is half of that. The most common size is the sixth plate, so it's about this size, about 3.25 by 2.75, I think it was. These are usually reversed. They have very sharp detail. It seems like we're going backwards as far as the clarity of these and preservation, because as I'll show you, if you find a daguerreotype that's in its original case, it can last for 150 or more years. If you leave a DVD someplace for 150 years, we won't be able to view it. So the thing about the daguerreotype, it's a copper plate that's coated with silver, and it's shiny. So depending on how you hold it, it's sort of hard to see. This just goes to show the point that they're laterally reversed. So this is a young Mark Twain, whose actual name is Samuel Clemens. He was a printer's devil, and he was pretty clever because he knew that printer's type is backwards, and he knew a daguerreotype would flip it, so it's correct reading. So this is really clever for a young Mark Twain to be showing that. But beware as you look, because wedding rings will look like they're on the right hand instead of the left hand. Or in one case, a woman told me that she had records for her War of 1812 ancestor who said he was missing his right arm, and she had an image of a man missing his left arm, and she never knew that that was the right person until she heard about this being reversed. Most daguerreotypes in these early processes were portraiture. I sure wish they documented every town and every street scene back in the 1850s, but it could be a single person or a family posing together. They were black and white, and they would apply coloring to the cheeks or gold to the jewelry, but it wasn't until much later that we had color photography. Here's a local one. This is one that Eleanor Arnold and Barbara, her daughter, had me scan for them. This is Dr. John Arnold. He's the man who built their farmhouse and lived at their farm for a long time. And we don't know if this was made locally, but by, and believe me, there are experts who know everything about any of these processes, but by the pebbled mat and the shape of the mat, it's probably from the 1840s. And he worked here in Rushville most of his life, and they have lots of stuff. I think they have every tooth he ever pulled in a jar. Really interesting stuff that they have from their family. Here's a couple more, and with these, I always get the question, why didn't they smile? You know, because everybody looks so stern. And so there are lots of myths about this. One is, oh, they didn't smile because they had bad teeth. Well, maybe the woman on the left had bad teeth, or your right had bad teeth, but obviously she wouldn't have at this point. So that just really doesn't stand. One of the rumors is because of the long exposure time, which in the very earliest months of daguerreotypes, it could take maybe 20 minutes for an exposure. But they got that down to less than 2-3 minutes very quickly. And you can smile for a minute or 2 minutes. So that's really not the reason. And what he's doing here is counting the seconds with a stopwatch, and he's taken the lens cap off, and of course the man's posing probably with a neck brace to keep him still. So it's not the time, really. The real reason people didn't smile for photography until snapshot photography is because we based photo portraiture on paintings. There was a precedent for how you looked in portraits. You never see people smiling in oil paintings or the little ivory paintings. You were asked to look pleasant. So here's a photographer from Fort Wayne who's been caricatured saying, now look pleasant. Honestly, I think a lot of people just look scared, you know, more than anything else. But the goal was to get them to look pleasant. Now, in Indiana, we were really in the frontier area at that point, where we did have photographers who would come from the East Coast, set up for a little while. They had wagons, they would travel around, even so far as a daguerrean barge on the Ohio River. And here is this photographer, Gorgas, who has his barge right there, and you can see the skylight. So you would walk into this and be photographed. And he traveled in the 1850s from Pittsburgh, even down the Mississippi River, all the way to New Orleans, photographing people. We also had people like this who went in these daguerreotype saloons that traveled around. A little bit about preservation. I've already said don't touch them, don't take them apart, don't try to clean them with silver dip or anything like that. Some of them start looking like this, and the problem with this one is not that the daguerreotype is flawed, it's the cover glass starts weeping, called weeping glass. And so simply by replacing a cover glass with a new piece of glass and then resealing it, this will look almost as good as new. So that's the main tip. Just leave them alone. In this case, really go to a specialist. All right, then the next process to come along is an ambrotype. And again, it's in a case, but it's made completely different other than having this light-sensitive silver chemistry. These are on glass, and again, they're put in this little brass mat. So 1854 to the early 1860s, it always varies. If you have an old photographer, sometimes they continue the process a while, but mainly they were going out of style by 1862. Again, they're almost always one of a kind. They weren't made from a negative from which multiple prints were made. Sometimes these are reversed, not always. And so here's one out of the frame. They're a little bit more gray, a little bit more muddy. The way you can tell these apart from daguerreotypes is they're not shiny like the daguerreotype is, and sometimes they look to have a little bit of depth, because what they are is a weak or a thin glass negative that is backed with black. And so when you put black paper or cloth or painting on the back, these clear areas look dark, and the gray areas tend to look more white. So here are a couple that show them half backed. And I like him. He's kind of smiling. That's what you were supposed to look like. Here's one that's painted black on the back or has dark varnish. And unfortunately, if it's painted right on the emulsion, if it starts flaking, it takes the image with it. So get these copied if it's starting to flake and you see any flaking going on.
Excuse me, and this one was called what?
Ambrotype.
Ambrotype.
Yeah. All right, so ambrotype was a close relative of the tintype, which was called a ferrotype or melanotype when they first came out. They took that same emulsion, collodion mixture, they poured it with the ambrotype, they poured it on glass. But then they said, why are we putting it on glass, which can break and which is heavy? So they started pouring this onto a blackened sheet iron. Piece of sheet iron. There's really no tin in a tintype. That's a misnomer. But we have some of those tintypes here, and I think probably most of you start having those in your collection. One tip, if they start looking a little bit more chocolate brown rather than a black, that usually dates it to after the 1870s. And again, these are usually laterally reversed. So here are just a couple. The earliest tintypes were still kept in these cases. And a way you can tell a tintype from the ambrotype and the daguerreotype is if you take a magnet and just put it up against the glass in front. If it sticks, it's a tintype. If it doesn't, it's more likely to be one of the other two. What I love about this one is the little hand coloring on his shoelaces. And I gave it away, but I was going to ask if you think this is a boy or girl. But a tip for dating these images, if you don't know if it's a boy or girl, because up until age 3 or 4, they would wear dresses instead of pants or breeches. They started saying you would be breeched when you're 3 or 5, and boys would start wearing their first pants. But anyway, boys almost always had side parts. Girls, through the decades, have almost always had center parts. So that's one way you can tell the sex of a toddler or baby. Here's another image of the 1870s, probably, that shows someone being photographed. And here you can see better that head brace that kept them in place. The photographer's still counting the couple seconds, but the price was going down. So here it says, walk in and have 6 ferrotypes made for 25 cents. Daguerreotypes could be anywhere from $1 to $5 if they were big and fancy photographers. But the price went down because they could have multiple lenses on the back of a camera. They would put in one large sheet of the metal, and they could take up to 4 or 16 or up to 30-some images on the plate in one sitting, and then they could process it and cut it apart. So prices went down. At this point, you started sharing your images more with friends and not just your closest family members. So also at this time, they started setting up at street fairs, and this is one, I believe this one is in Muncie, because that's a Muncie photographer, but here you can see his photo tent and his samples that he has displayed on the wall. They started also doing some fun and interesting things with them. You could buy these props and hold in front of you while you were photographed to get some kind of gag photographs. And not that they didn't do interesting things with daguerreotypes. They did do some street scenes. They photographed dead people from the beginning, and actually within months of the invention of photography in Paris, they were making pornographic daguerreotypes. So it's not like it was all portraiture from the very beginning, but I think when the price went down, they started being more creative with the process. Because in the early 1860s, they started varnishing the tintypes. That would protect them. They didn't need to be in the case. And also because there was a need to send photographs and portraits during the Civil War from the home front to where the boys were fighting, they started putting them in these little paper sleeves. And make sure you save these because those are your dating clues. You know, the name of the photographer, the city, even the design of this can help date the image. So don't throw those away because you think they might be acidic. Here's an interesting tintype of... I imagine this was a local painter who traded, made a deal with the photographer. I'll paint your backdrop if you do some free portraits for me. So by the 1870s and really big into the 1880s, you start seeing elaborate backdrops. Victorian era was fussy and, you know, lots of props and things. So that's another way I can date photographs, by looking how fancy the backdrop is and the props in them. As I said, post-mortem or death photographs were made from the very beginning, and I've seen very poignant ads where photographers or daguerreotypists say, "I will come to your house on the moment's notice to photograph your recently departed loved one." And at first it was because they wouldn't have had a portrait of this person. It would be their last chance to capture their likeness. But it continued until the 1920s when it started going out of style, and it seems really creepy to us now, but it was just another part of life, and they dealt with mortality much more than we did, especially infant mortality. So it was just a part of life. They had their mourning customs, and this was part of it, having a photograph. I gave a talk where some, 13, 14-year-old boys were the only ones in the audience. They were Hispanic boys. And they said, "Well, we've always taken," and that's true, the Hispanic community has always done postmortem photography. But a new trend with young people is they take selfies with their grandma in the casket. You know, I said, "Well, did you get in trouble for that?" And they're like, "Yeah, but why? Because we just document everything." So maybe their view will be different than our view about what is appropriate with photography. Just a couple more to show what happens with tintypes. Because they're metal, they can rust. So you want to make sure you keep them in cool and dry environments, and you see the rust on the corners there. And as I pointed out when he was showing me his tintypes, they started clipping the corners because it would make it easier to slide into photo albums. So, you know, you don't see clipped corners usually in the 1850s tintypes, but you do in the 70s, 80s, and on. Okay, so there was a big change in the late 1850s and then into the 1860s and on, where they started making negatives from which multiple prints could be made. And I'm not going to go into detail on all of these, but the first couple were glass negatives, and then we got into plastic-based negatives. And now we're into the no-negative phase, which I think, when's the last any of you made a negative? I'm always curious. Anybody in the last 5 years?
Can you even? I mean...
Yeah, you can, and actually they're sort of...
Can I film to make...
You still can.
I didn't even know you could buy film anymore.
Okay. Yeah, it's a real... Yeah, it's become sort of an alternative process, you know, but there's a whole group of people that actually you can still do Polaroids. Instagram and Polaroid have gone together. There's another company. So you can still make Polaroids, except it's hugely expensive.
Are there still places that develop film?
Yeah, for the most part, you have to send them out somewhere. But you can go to... Costco or Walgreens or a place like that. They don't do it in local labs, but they send it out.
What about the negatives?
Pardon me?
Is it negatives? So I had trouble finding some place
that will print your negatives?
Yeah,
that's a little harder. I know Indianapolis places who do it. I don't know of anybody around here who does it. It usually has to be more of a specialized or an amateur photographer who's doing it, because a lot of us don't want to send our negatives to Seattle Filmworks in Washington. But there are a few places that will do it, and I can get you some national names if you want. So I just want to show you this just briefly to show you how much more complicated it was back then. Because when you made the first glass negatives, you had to get the glass, you had to sand it so it wouldn't be sharp. You had to buff it so it wouldn't have any oils on it. You had to coat the plate with this collodion mixture that you mixed up. It was like Karo syrup. You had to pour it on, pour it around. Then you had to get in the dark. You had to sensitize it in this silver bath in the dark, because when you took it out, it's going to be light sensitive. You had to get it in the back of your camera, your plate holder, in the back of the camera. You had to go out, photograph whatever you're photographing. You had to get it back in. You had to develop the plate. You had to wash it. You had to fix it in cyanide, of all things. You had to wash it. You had to let it dry. You had to varnish it. And then you had to make the prints. So it was a very complicated process. And it's called wet collodion because you had to do this first part. You had to expose it before it dried. If it dried, it was no longer light sensitive. So imagine these guys who were going out in Yosemite with huge mammoth plates, who went with their mules and all their glass bottles of chemicals to do this. It's really quite amazing. Not many of these collections survive because they would reclaim and recycle the silver. There's one of Abraham Lincoln that they have at the Indiana Historical Society. Until recently, I didn't know of any other collections around of this early type. But then several years ago now, I got a call from the Greensburg. Sorry, I get my greens mixed up. Greensburg's the one with the tree in the courthouse,
yes.
Right? Okay, the Greensburg Library called and said they were re-roofing the hardware on the square, and they found these glass negatives up on the third floor. And so I thought, oh, it's just probably the, you know, there are a lot of the other types of glass negatives. But lo and behold, these are the early types. So they were just all over the floor, soot, you know, bird droppings, feathers. So they hired us to clean all of them. They found about 400, and they could afford to have about 200 cleaned of the best ones. So we cleaned them very delicately, and we scanned them. And this is before cleaning, and this is after cleaning. And so they really cleaned up beautifully. And the exciting things about these is a few of them had numbers, but some had names on the back. So the librarian there was really diligent and had a blog about this. She was able, because of the chair and the oilcloth on the bottom, we were able to determine there were four photographers who worked in that space. And we found them on the old Sanborn fire insurance maps, and we were able to date these. The earliest one is a Civil War soldier, and this was a cool story because on the edge it said Maury Arnold. We couldn't read it at first, but she put it in the paper, and family members came forward. So someone in Rushville, this was a Rush County person, and they found the records, and he survived the war. And his picture survived 150 years of bad exposure up in that place. And so they have these at the library. And I don't know if they have them all up on their web page or not. But they're fascinating, and you just never know what you might discover. So because those had to be wet and it was complicated, they came up with an easier glass negative in 1880 called dry plate gelatin negatives. And you could buy them already coated, ready to go, and put in your camera. They could be dry till you process them. And so they're usually in the original plates like this. We like storing them in four flap sleeves to keep, you know, an upright to preserve them. And they can be scanned beautifully. Here's one also from the Arnold family. He's actually the photographer. We think this is about 1905, 1910. The way we know this is an early selfie is because he's holding a pneumatic bulb with a tube that goes as a shutter release for his camera. So that's kind of a cool one to show that at this point a lot of amateur photographers started taking their own images. All right. Then they started coming up with plastic-based around the late 1880s. It was lighter and it was faster processing. The problem is cellulose nitrate, film base, is very combustible and it deteriorates in a horrible way. The best way to show it is this can of film where it actually starts oozing. The state librarian told me in the 1950s she remembered cans of film up in the fourth floor of the state library, and the film was oozing out of the canisters. The problem with that is it is combustible, can spontaneously combust. So they had a lot of fires in movie theaters where they had this film, and the worst case was in the early 1920s where they had X-ray department in Cleveland that had a huge fire, and it killed 20-some people, not from the fire, but from, it was outgassing nitric acid, which was bad for people. So they were motivated to come up with a safety negative, which is acetate negatives. And so these were fine until maybe the 1950s or 60s, and now, because they are dimensionally unstable. So an 8 by 10 inch negative can shrink an inch in each direction, and the emulsion, which is a different layer, will wrinkle. So this is called the vinegar syndrome, usually because it outgasses acetic acid, which smells like vinegar. So, you know, this is safer, but a lot of our history is just being lost. Now, if you just have a small family collection of just a few of these, it won't be bad, but large collections, like where John worked in Lafayette Historical Society, I could tell walking into the building they had a room full of these because it smells so strong. It smells like vinegar. So it's important if you see them starting to go like this to get them scanned. Then from all of these negatives, they started making multiple prints, and I'm going to go quickly through these so we'll have time to get through everything. But the first process is albumin process, and this is egg whites. So what they did is they needed a binder or a glue that would hold the silver, light-sensitive silver, on the paper where it wouldn't absorb in like watercolors. So they tried honey and different methods, but they found that egg white, salted egg white, was a good way to make it kind of a shiny photograph. So these were popular from late 1850s, really died out in the 1890s. Let me see, you can identify them just by the way they look. They're this brownish color. This isn't sepia toned. That's sort of my pet peeve. Everyone thinks that brown photos were sepia toned. When this one was made originally, it would have been a blackish purple color. Our photographs have faded, so they look like this. And the worse they're stored, the more they faded. You see this one here is more yellow on the edge. It was probably in an album where the air came in from the edge. It's a little better preserved over here. And here's another one. They get kind of this icky yellow brown color. This is from 1888. A few others that are very easy to identify. Crayon enlargements, and Carol brought one in. I'm trying to gently hold this up so you can see it. So this is called a crayon enlargement. They're kind of eerie because they look like charcoal drawings, or crayon was pastel, what was pastel was called back then. So it's a photograph, a faint photograph that has been hand-colored a little bit. And so what was important about these was before that point, they only contact printed negatives. So the size of your negative was the size of your print. With these, common in the 1860s through even into the 1920s, they started enlarging glass negatives. And of course, we didn't have electricity yet, so they would use a mirror out their window. The sunlight would hit it. It would project through their enlarging camera onto light-sensitive paper. So that would have been, there were various ways to do it. This was one way. So yours would have been exposed like that. It could take many hours. And if it took 8 hours, of course the sun is moving. So they had to sometime move the camera or everything. I know someone who's making these in Rochester, one of my professors, and he said he went down for lunch, and when he came up, it was smoking because he didn't move it fast enough, and it started burning the leather bellows. So because they were impatient and they knew they would color them, they simply made very light images in which they would hand color. And so here's a great image that came in recently. I don't know who these guys are, probably Indiana, but this was a specialty, and they were very cheap. They would just go over with pastel or color, usually black and white, but there are some variations. And some are just horrible. They're just comically bad. And some are just really almost works of art. And they even airbrush the backdrops, and even later they did convex shaped ones of farms, and they would color those in. So there's a lot of variation of these. I think they're really quite fascinating, but keep them framed, especially if they're convex, because they can get cracked very easily. And it was very common to put them up in the parlors, and then Victorian frames get out of style and they go to the attic. Another one that's really easy to identify is a cyanotype, which is a blue print, and it's really related to the architectural blueprint in process with iron and iron processes. This was popular 1880 through the 1920s, used mainly by amateur photographers. It wasn't flattering to our skin tones, so it was not used for portraiture, but here's a postcard of a cyanotype. And for those of you familiar with printing process, a cyan, of course, is the blue. So here's a lovely little kitten postcard. And they could actually coat it on fabric, and they made quilts out of them sometimes, too. But a lot of amateurs did this because it was simple to process in your own bathroom. Just you needed running water, not horrible chemistry like some of the others. All right, color photography came about as early as 1907. They were using autochromes, which are on glass. That didn't take off. That was more high-end photography. But by about 1935, they started making chromogenic photographs, just typical of what we all grew up with. They were made of three dyes, cyan, magenta, and yellow dyes, and it was delayed a little bit because of World War II. A lot of, like, Kodak and others started working on war efforts. But by 1960, the majority of our photographs were in color. Kennedy was the first president photographed more in color than black and white. And so the problem, if you think of dyes, if you have dyed curtains or a dyed fabric with the sunlight hitting it for 20 years, what you're going to have is the dyes will fade. So that's what happens to our photographs. So if you have a photograph that's been on display for many, many years, or in a window, like a store window where they sponsored a baseball team or something, the yellow and red dyes will fade and they will look very, very blue. So you think, well, we'll just keep them in the dark. They fade in the dark as well. The blue dye fades. So my whole childhood is orange yellow, you know, because that's where we kept my photographs. So here's one of the Ball brothers of Ball Jars, and you can see that the blue and the red dyes have faded. It's very yellow, kind of greenish color. Depending on how they're stored, these were stored differently. This one had more light than that one did, so it survived better. Ektachrome was kind of icky. It faded a little bit more. Kodachrome was great because it had vibrant colors. So whether you had Kodachrome prints or slides, they've stayed pretty true to their bright colors. They stopped making Kodachrome in 2009, so if you have a roll of undeveloped Kodachrome, good luck. You can only have it processed in black and white these days. But there's hope for these, so don't go throwing away your photographs because they look faded, because when I was in graduate school, a student that I went to school with had developed this software program. She figured out what percentage of dyes would fade based on if it's ektachrome from 1950 or other films through different years, and could bring it back. And with Photoshop, you can enhance them. Even though it looks like all the blue is gone, that's what she got. That wasn't hand-colored. That was there. It was latent in the image. Okay, slides. How many of you have boxes of slides still? And this is a big question I'm getting a lot of lately. What do we do with these slides? Because there are so many of them. First of all, I tell you to weed them out, because you can find postcards of Mount Rushmore. You can find postcards of the ocean. It's more important to save your family photographs and your farm photographs and your house and things that will matter to your family. So I hate throwing photos away, but in these cases, tough love is what's required. Get rid of a lot of these, and then you can scan them at very high resolution. And at that point, if you want to get rid of the slides, okay, I still think you should save the originals. These date back to the 1940s is the earliest you really start seeing some in the 1930s, and they're usually 35 millimeter. So it's important to keep them in their cardboard or plastic mounts, because that stops them from curling. And you can simply dust over them and scan them. There are slide scanners that do this specially, or you can put them on a flatbed scanner if you have the right type. Polaroid is another one that I remember from childhood. 1948 is the earliest we started having the Land camera. Edwin Land came up with the Polaroid. And I think probably we're all of the age that you can look at this and almost smell that squeegee, whatever that chemical smell was. If they didn't get it distributed evenly, you sometimes see streaks. And these are very susceptible to scratches, so you want to make sure you store them in individual sleeves if it's an important image to you. And there are all sorts of dating clues on these. On the back, there's a code. Unfortunately, they didn't put the year on the back, but there's a code on there, and if anybody's interested in that, maybe I'll add it to this slideshow. You can date them by the year that it was manufactured. They started making color Polaroids in 1963, and then Kodak started making Polaroid-like images, but they were sued, and they had to stop. All right, just to give you an idea of there are lots and lots of other paper processes. I mean, this can be a four-year class and how to date all of these. But so I can look at your photographs, and I'll stay as long as you want and tell you an idea of dating some of these. I'm going to skip that. Okay, quickly on the formats. When they started making prints from your negatives, they would mount them on cardboard, because the early albumin especially would curl if it wasn't mounted flat. So they mounted them. There are all sorts of sizes, and this is in the slideshow, so you can look it up from home and get a better idea of some of these. I'll talk about the most common formats. So here's just an example of an albumin. We can tell it's albumin because it's that yellow color. It also kind of looks like it has little cracks on it. And I think if you coated egg white on a plate and left it on your kitchen counter for 100 years, of course it would crack and turn yellow. So that's another way to remember these albumin egg white images. The most common size format in 1860 through about 1890s up into 1900 is called a carte de visite, and it's a visiting card in French, and it's about 4.5 by 2.5 inch, so a small photograph. They were stored in albums, and they were usually albumin. So like I say, these are pretty tiny. The way you can start dating these is the earliest ones are vignetted, have a lot of white around them, and usually have a double border around the edge. They're also very thin cardboard. Through the years, the cardboard gets thicker, and they start rounding the corners more. This one's mid-1860s. They started having this tasseled frame. She's in mourning. And I should say, you have to be careful in determining that somebody is in mourning. You might say, oh, they look like they're wearing black, so I'm going to assume they're dressed in mourning clothing. Well, even a dark orange will look black in film, or a red will look black. So you don't know what color it is, but based on her veil and everything else, I think she looks like she's in mourning clothing. The one on your right, then, is later, probably 1880s. Based on the clothing, it's a thicker mount, and they started really putting these fancy backdrops in. All right, so here's a quiz for you. Based on clothing, what date would you think this one would be?
1920.
Keep guessing. Think of Gone.
1880.
Getting close. Think of Gone with the Wind and with the hoop skirt. So these hoop skirts were very, very common in the 1860s. I don't know how they even sat or got through doorways at all. But by the 1870s, they were tighter fitting dresses with bustles going in back. And so there are lots and lots of great books, and I'm sure they have some here. One is called Dressed for the Photographer, that is my Bible for these early photographs. You can also note that she's posed in front of real wood props. By the 1880s, they started making fake papier-mâché props. This is also a double border that I told you about, dating it to the 1860s. Here's one. We're lucky if they dated them. So this guy from Indianapolis, Cadwallader, well, he didn't date it, probably. The mother probably dated this one. It says February 4, 74, 6 months. But what did they forget to record? The name. So, and that's, I think, one of the biggest preservation problems is we don't have names on the back. But even if the date hadn't been there, I can give you clues on dating this because I'm writing a book about Indiana photographers. I know when Cadwallader moved to town, and actually he worked in the Beehive building, and that's his little hint that he was in the Beehive building only for a few years. So if anyone's interested, email me with names of photographers and I can help you out with that. Other ways to date some of these early ones by the obviously the photographer, but the name on the back, when it's very small and simple, that's more likely to be the 1860s. And during the Civil War, they had tax revenue stamps. So this is actually an orange stamp, and it says A.W. for A. Wilkinson, January 10, 65. So they only used these stamps between 1864 and 1866. They taxed luxury items such as chewing tobacco and playing cards and photographs. So that can be a real clue as to when that was made. You might also You might also find this NPA logo, which is the National Photographic Association. They used this in the mid-1870s. At this point, they banded together and they were fighting that tax stamp. And so if you were in a good standing member in order, you could use that logo. A couple of things to be aware of. Not every photo in your album is your family. It was common to have performers and celebrities that you would buy their portraits. So the Haywards were probably traveling through. Just because a president's in your album doesn't mean they knew him. All right, then the next process to come around, is a cabinet card. And so this is 1870 to about 1900, and it's a larger image, about 6 1/4 by 4 1/2, varies just a little bit. And here are just a few of these. The names started going at the bottom. And here, just be really observant Now that's a little bit later. That's a card mounted one, but that one's, these are very specific to this size.
Okay.
So the photographer's name's here, but look, be observant. Always have a magnifying glass when you're going through, because sometimes you can identify them. That's it. Yep, that's the size right there. This was one I got on eBay, but what fascinated me, not only that he had his camera, but what's going on with his shoes. And I wasn't quite sure, but I found his family members on Ancestry, and Chisholm, the photographer, was club-footed. And so that told me for sure this is him, not just one of his assistants. Another thing to note about these larger cabinet cards is people liked the larger size, but they were freaking out because their faces were larger, and now you could see every freckle, every pimple, every wrinkle in their face. So they started hiring retouchers to retouch the negatives as well as the prints, so they started smoothing out the faces. Photoshop is really nothing new as far as that goes. So cabinet cards could be full standing images like this. It could be a group taken outside. It could be a whole family or just one person. Beware when you start seeing soldier photographs, because people think every soldier is a Civil War soldier. And I'm always the bearer of bad news. I'm sorry, that can't be a Civil War soldier. This guy doesn't have a Civil War uniform. He's probably Indian Wars. This is probably 1880s. So just be aware. Always consult experts and books on those topics. And again, the back, even the design of the back stamp can really be helpful in dating these. And just one more that was probably a novelty one that somebody bought, even though I doubt if they lived in Marengo, Indiana. All right, a couple real important points here. With this one, even though you know this is a cabinet card, even though I've looked up when DeLong, Stanton and DeLong, worked in Michigan in the 1890s, it's a white mount, it has a gold beveled edge. Everything about that mount says 1890s, but look at the image itself, because she looks like a daguerreotype. So because they only had one daguerreotype, they would take it, you know, as we get sentimental and into genealogy older, we would take the only known daguerreotype of grandma to the photographer in the 1890s. They would make a copy negative of it from which they would make multiple prints. So you can't just go by the format. You really have to look at the subject. And I can tell she's probably 1840s by her clothing, her hairstyle, and I can even see the tarnish along the top. So you have to use a combination of the clues within. And then one that was a revelation to me when I was young is the name on the back. I was going through grandma's photos with her. I was lucky to start young. And they all said Retha, 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 and all these little girls, but they didn't look like her, and they looked different. And she just looked at me like I was an idiot, and she said, "Well, no, you knew who it was. You wrote who you were giving it to." You know, because obviously you knew that. You would get a dozen photos. You would write, "This is to Retha, this is to Jane, this is to Susan." So be very careful of what's written on the back and start comparing photographs to known images of the people. All right, and then we start getting into larger and different formats. And after about 1900, it wasn't as formulaic. They started coming up with various different sizes. This one is a little bit shorter than a cabinet card, and it has a lot more of a beveled pattern around it. I date this to around 1900, 1905. One interesting thing about it is her brooch, which is a photo button. And so if you have any of those in your collections or showing in the photographs, these were very common during the Spanish-American War, late 1890s, up to about 1915 is about the latest. And so you could have your portrait copied and put into these little jewelry brooches. All right, snapshots then really took off. 1888 is when George Eastman and Kodak came up with snapshot photography. Several things have happened at that point. They started making plastic-based film that would be in rolls. You had faster film, so you no longer needed a tripod. And they started making handheld amateur cameras. And so you could snap these photographs and buy, there were box cameras at first, eventually more like this. So George Eastman was really brilliant because he had his little box camera and he advertised, you push the button and we do the rest. So you would buy the camera, roll of 100 pictures on the film. You actually didn't push a button. You would pull a string and pull something else to make it go forward. When you were finished with it, you would send the camera, film and all, back to Rochester, New York, where Eastman Kodak would work. They would develop the film. They would process the film, and then they would print it using these printing frames, and again, with sunlight. So they used primarily women to contact print and make your prints. They would put more film in the camera, send it back to you, and it was about $25 to get that done. So that was pretty expensive at first, but the price kept going down. Eastman was brilliant because he would say, it's so easy, even women and children can do it. But he was aware that women controlled the photo budget, and I think he knew that children would waste a lot of film. And so at this point, people started documenting their everyday lives. People started smiling for the camera. They started documenting interiors when they started having magnesium flash powder. And if you're lucky, they wrote on the back, but a lot of times they didn't. The earliest snapshots were mounted on cardboard like this, but eventually they were just prints. So start looking for any clues you can. I think many, many photographs can be identified. It was a long time before I realized the date was actually down on this one. But if I had this one, I would wonder who in my family was in the GAR or had been in the Civil War. If I know whose house it is, when did my town have a GAR parade? You can go to old newspapers now to look up a lot of this information. If there's a car in your snapshot photographs, luckily in Indiana, they started requiring a year on the license plate after about 1913-14. So I always zoom in on the license plate. If not, there are a lot of people who are great at dating old cars. Even if you have ones that are highly faded like this, this is one came into the Indiana album. They were dated. It said September 1900, the Indiana State Fair. And she said, I was going to throw these away. We just found them in my parents' attic. The cool thing about this is once I scanned them and then we started enhancing them, I thought, where were they standing? And it was about where the horticulture building is today. So you can look out, and I thought, well, I think he overlapped. So I was able to put the three scans together to make this panoramic photo of the Indiana State Fair. Which is really amazing. They didn't even have panoramic cameras in 1900. But so, if those of you are familiar, here's the grandstand, here's the track. We're looking east on the main road. 38th Street would be down here. The only thing I did wrong is I didn't know how many windows would be in here, so I got one extra window. I finally found it in a postcard. But it's really amazing what detail can be found in these photographs. All right, they started putting them in albums in about 1860, and I say up to the present, but I'm not sure many people do albums anymore. We're more likely to print out digital photo books so that you can get from Costco and different places, but I'll show you some of the most common kinds. The early ones were these Victorian albums. They had a slit at the bottom, and you would slide your photograph up into there. And be very, very careful because this is acidic, brittle paper. Just go very slowly as you want to identify and see if anything's written on the back. Wear gloves, gently pull them out, put a piece of paper behind to guide it. And while you're doing it, type up your results. You know, if there are names on the back, type it all up and keep your inventory with this so people won't manhandle it through the years. This is a combination one with the carte de visite on this side and cabinet cards on this side. With the snapshot photographs of Kodak, they actually started gluing some of them into these early albums. Or more like my parents' generation and grandparents' generation, they would either glue them into these black acidic pages, or use the photo corners. And you're lucky if they use the photo corners because they come out more easily. But what conservators recommend is to leave your albums intact. Even though this is acidic, it tells a story. There might be an order to them that if you pull them all out, you might lose the context of it might all be one event or all one family. Many times they didn't record the names in India ink like they have done here. So what I have done with older relatives, or my Aunt Eva would write, Grandpa on the farm. Well, that doesn't help anybody. So I made a note in the front that said the India ink is by Eva Hostetler Good. This album of the Amos Hostetler family, Monroe Township, Kosciuszko County. Then I'd say the white pencil is by Joan Hostetler. You know, tell a story to the next generations. And then I went through and said, where she said Grandpa, I would say Amos Hostetler, and I would give the address if I knew it. So try to record all of that. You can put pieces of acid-free paper between the pages, and you can even get acid-free tissue paper at Joanne Fabrics, which is a lot less expensive, and just cut it and put it in there. Especially if you have newspaper clippings, because you know how they turn yellow and will damage other things, you just try to protect the photographs. The exception to keeping albums together are these horrid so-called magnetic albums. These have adhesive stripes on them. It's a bad type of plastic, it's a bad type of cardboard, and two things can happen. Either it won't stick and your photos will fall out, or more likely, it's so hard to get it off of there. And so recommended ways to remove them is you can take a little micro spatula or thin knife, try to stick it under there, see if they'll pop up. If that doesn't work, conservators take dental floss, and you can wrap it around your fingers and get it under a corner and kind of saw back and forth. That will work to remove them sometimes. I know some people will take a hair dryer too and direct it to heat up the adhesive a little bit. The problem is when you remove them, they're sticky on the back. So you don't want to stack your photographs. You want to put them in another album or at least interleave them so they don't stick together. All right, postcards, real photo postcards, popular 1905 to even beyond the 1920s. These are typical size postcards, but a lot of amateur photographers would make their own negatives and print their own. Sometimes you're lucky and you'll find that they wrote with India ink on the negative, which would print here. A lot of times people wrote on the back. And here's a really cool one that just came into the Indiana album. If you follow along on Facebook, this one was from French Lick, and luckily it had his name, Yarmouth Wigginton. And luckily that's such a unique name, I was able to look him up in Indiana newspapers. And he was an African-American man from French Lick who was the designated Pluto for Pluto water. So, and what was their slogan? What nature won't, Pluto will. So he was the one in the wells outside there who would dip up the water and give it to the people, and they would drink it and stroll around until they had to use the strategically placed outhouses that were out in the park. But anyway, he was a longtime figure in African-American man in French Lick who had that job. Here's another postcard. Sometimes you would go to a fair and pose in props like this. One good dating clue on these, when you start seeing the girls with those huge bows, I usually think of that as about 1905 to 19. Even 1908 to 1912 seems to be the height of popularity. And so a photograph like this would be taken in a photo tent at a fair. And here's one in Knightstown where this fellow was the photographer, and there's a car inside there, and he would process it, he says, within 10 minutes. A couple good clues in this one, just to be observant. Someone pointed out in one of the workshops that you always look at the flags because they alternated the rows of stars based on how many states we had at the time. So it wasn't until 1912 that they aligned like this. So whoever speculated it was a left drive on the car, so it must be 1913, it's a little bit later than that. And what we're noticing for our Indiana Album Project and just photography in general is African Americans and minorities weren't photographed as often. So these have much more value. We're really working out to get more diversity in our collection. Other ways to date your postcards under the stamp. So if you don't have a stamp there, these stamp blocks can narrow down the date. So there are guides. If you just look up stamp blocks, there are many, many guides from postcard collectors and stamp collectors giving you those dates. And obviously, if it's postmarked, you know the images before that. Before 1907, the U.S. Post Office would not let you write anything except the address on the back of the postcard. So you don't see the split back for correspondence and address until 1907 and later. It was sometime mid-year that they requested that. All right, a few more types. The folder easel photograph was around 1905, and even up to present, some senior photos come in these. They can be self-standing easels, or they can be open-up kind of photographs. And keep those, again, because it has the date and the style of it can help you date the photographs. For example, if it looks more Art Deco, that might give you a clue. The name of the photographer, again, is a good clue.
Here's one.
Yeah, I've got one
too. Yeah, those were really, really common. Now, one thing I like to do with my photographs, it's not necessary, but I don't like that that's the acidic board that hits the photograph, so I try to interleaf those so that doesn't touch them. Also, if they're like this one where the flaps come down at different spots, I make sure that the longer flap is on top of the photograph and the shorter flap is here. You want the air to go in evenly, or interleave those. All right, panoramic photographs, they usually have some hanging around, but we don't here. So panoramic photographs are these very elongated views made with, either it could be someone taking pictures like this and gluing them together, or after 1905 they had a circuit camera that would span the whole area. And so here are a couple of these. Actually, this is the Wendell Willkie notification celebration in Elwood. Oh, what was that, 1940? So that one's kind of a tall one. Here is one in another state, but you can see that it's a long image. They're anywhere from 6 inches to 14 inches tall, 30 inches, and I've seen them 9, 12 feet long. This camera would sit on a tripod, and it would have a large rolled negative inside of it. And then so the photographer would line up the group of people in a semicircle, equal distant from the camera. And then they would rotate the camera as the mechanism inside rolled that film, kept it going. So they were only exposing part of it at a time. So the fun thing about it is once it swung past the first person, he could run to the other side and get in the photograph twice. So I have an example of one here. You can see this fellow here. He either ran in front or back and went to the other side. So those are interesting. But these are a bear to take care of because you either have them in the large frames, they were never matted and they're stuck to the glass, or they're rolled and they crack when you unroll them. So always make sure you humidify them. Contact me if you need help with that, but we simply put it in a Tupperware with bowls of damp sponges and let it sit for several hours. We press it down as it loosens and then we flatten it for several days till it stays flat. Now, I just threw in a couple oddball dating things here at the end. one thing that's helpful as you're trying to deal with your boxes of unknown people is to have someone with a good eye for it. And this truly is a thing. Some people, Brad Pitt says he does not recognize people. There are some people who just do not get it. I think I'm pretty good. I think I've seen a lot of people who are good. I've seen some people who don't even recognize themselves, which seems really bizarre to me. But so here's an example of these twins and school teachers from northern Indiana. How many of you feel that you can tell which one is which? With pretty confident. I mean, it surprises me.
It's a very distinctive chin.
Mm-hmm. Right. She has a very distinct chin.
And one's got a long, elongated face on the twins.
Yeah, and the other one has more of a heart-shaped face. They say before age 14 and after, I don't know who comes up with this, but after age 67, it's harder to identify. Maybe facial recognition program has a hard time with that. Mm. But anyway, if you have people who are good with faces, you can compare them. Try to think why people were photographed or rephotographed. For example, this is an ancestor of mine who died at age 40. It was the only known photograph of him. So it was copied over and over again by different family members. And also, don't trust the spelling, even if it's family, because that's not how you spelled Isaac. Also, beware of trickery with photography, even back then. This is the actual photograph of a man, and I knew he had gout and illness through his older years in life, and he looks very thin, but when he was photographed, or a lithograph was done for a commemorative biographical issue in the 1880s, they filled him in. You know, I think they made him look healthier and a little thicker in the face to make him look a little healthier. Also, if you can get a group of family photographs together of the same person and try to get them in order. Sometimes I'm just not sure if it's the same person. I wasn't positive that she was this woman. I still have a little bit of a doubt, but I got them in order by year as close as I could, and what I noticed then is she's wearing the same watch slide. You can't see the watch, but she's wearing that, and then I realized later her daughter was wearing that too. So you start noticing things about family members when you get them together. Now, as you do come up with the names, always use pencil to write on the back and be very specific. Full names. You don't want to use ink because you don't want to emboss or you don't want it to bleed. But sometimes that it's just too complicated to write it fully on the back. So in that case, you could do this on a photocopy too. But in this case, I tried to really spell out who I figured each child was, and even I told the stories that I heard to go along with it, because I think the stories are just as important. I love the fact that this is the woman who gave it to me, Princess Kelly. And in her late 80s, she was still a little annoyed that she didn't get to sit right on Grandma's lap because she was the youngest. And she should have been there. So I recorded her story. Another example of not trusting photographs, and the Eleanor Arnold collection had a lot of these. They did trick photography. So this one said, "This is me photographing myself." And you can tell that there's a dark or light area down the center, but they covered part of the negative, took it, and covered the other half. So it's surprising how often you see things like that, or they would add people into group photographs if they passed away, look for things like that. Here's another one that came my way. Someone said, "Do you think this is the same person?" You know, and I think clearly it is. What threw them is one was reversed, and then when we flipped it, we really felt it was the same person. Okay, just how are we doing time-wise? Can I keep going just a little bit for photo preservation?
Sure.
It's 10 to 1.
Well, and we got started later, too. Okay, well, I'll just keep going just a little bit. This is real important. So caring for your photographs, I find we do the most damage to our collections. We will store them improperly. We'll keep the light hitting on them for a long time. We'll be in a rush for something, and we'll tape them up to a temporary board, and then we can't get the adhesive off. I've done that myself. I'm guilty of some of these. Something will be damaged, and we'll try to fix it ourselves with adhesive. I was telling someone my dad used duct taped on the back of one of my tintypes. As they sent me to graduate school for photo preservation, he was putting duct tape on the back of our family photos. So don't try to do repairs like that, because some of these, you know, tape is horrible. Here's an example. It turns yellow and it will darken and it will fall off anyway. Laminating is one of the worst things you can do for your photographs. Don't get a laminating machine like that in the back of the room and run it in, because basically it's sticking to it and it's cooking in its own juices if it's acidic at all. Don't rough handle them like this. Don't touch them. The oils of your hands are bad. You want to keep them cool and dry and dark. A moisture and flooding can be horrible because it's almost impossible to get mold off of photographs. So don't keep them in the basement, where even if you think your basement has never flooded, there's always that first time, and that's just really difficult to remove. I've already shown you the writing on the back. Try to be more like this woman who keeps it in archival boxes and keeps them safe. Because I think if we take the time to preserve them like this, our families will think this must be important. Okay, I'm going to go quickly through some of these. You don't want to be like this person with your photographs. When you're working on them, you don't want the cat there, the glass of red wine. You don't want it to get lost in everything. Try to think like an archivist. Don't let your grandchildren come around and color on them. Let me see some of those. I have some pictures of some of these. All right, the archival boxes, and this is in the handout, so I won't go into great detail on it, but you want to go with acid-free and lignin-free, which is really spelled out in there, because if you go with a cardboard or paper, that's the best thing that won't cause damage to the photographs over time. If you go with plastic sleeves like you see here, there are good types of plastics, but you want to avoid polyester is good, polyethylene is good, polyvinyl chloride, excuse me. PVC, if it smells like a new shower curtain or a beach ball, that's really bad type of plastic to store your images in. Where you store them is really important. You don't want to keep them in wood that can be outgassing. You don't want to keep them in a room that you're painting, because the fumes from paint are really destructive to the emulsion of your photographs. It's best to use metal and powder-coated finish is really preferred, but we can't do that in our homes as well, so try to keep metal and not wood. So whether you use plastic-based or paper-based, it's ideal to keep the precious photographs in their own sleeve, keep them in a folder, and you can put 20, 30, whatever, in a folder, and keep those in archival boxes, and you want to then keep them. Don't worry about all of this. If you get the archival quality, that will be covered. And you want to keep them, like I say, cool, dry, and dark. So that's the most important thing. I find it, we can't control our home environment. Most of us like it closer to 68, 70, even higher than that sometimes. It's ideal to keep photographs 60 degrees or cooler. So our homes aren't like that. If you have an air-conditioned bedroom that's in the dark, keep them in there and that will be fine. All right, I've said quite a bit of that. Glass negatives we don't have. All right, if you have photographic albums, I recommend don't keep them on display, because they get light, they get dust, they get handled more. Wrap them in acid-free paper and just store them in a box in a cool, dark place. cased images the same, just wrap them up. Okay, and then I want to get to the digital part. Digital photography is the most difficult part of photo preservation. It's great for things like restoring photographs and bringing out the detail. You know, a faded photograph, that took about 5 seconds to bring out all of that detail and just to touch it up a little bit and burn it in a little bit. But the problem is, and I think of when I went to my parents' farm and cleaned out their farm, they had photos, but I could grab the trunk, I could grab the boxes, I could take them home in my leisure, sort through them. But if they were in the digital world for 10, 20 years, I would have to figure out what's their system, and they may not have a system. I'd have to find out where are their hard drives and get everything captured. Not only that, they may have years' worth of floppy drives, these proprietary photo CD discs that are hard to use anymore. They have jazz zip drives that I may not have a player for. They may have the little thumb drives. Not only that, I might have to go to their old cameras. Do they still have things on their cameras and their phones? Can I play these? I might have hard drives that may or may not work. If they're like us, there may be a graveyard of old drives that we're not sure we have everything saved yet, so we keep all this old equipment. Although the man behind the curtain did get rid of a lot of stuff, and I'm still worried we might have lost some stuff. And they may not just have photographs they've taken, they may have photographs that they've scanned themselves. So where are those? Do they have a cataloging system? Maybe they've been exchanging genealogy emails with a cousin in California who's been sending scans, so I have to go through their email system. Not only that, it just seems to go on and on. Are they paying for the cloud, like Carbonite? Are they paying for Dropbox? Are they putting on a paid Flickr account? And every year, there are more and more of these. If they've been paying for those and go in a nursing home, what happens if they don't pay the bill for 2 months? Do I have their password? Am I listed as someone to contact if they stop paying? So you need to start finding out their passwords now, recording all of that so you can get it in one place. There's all sorts of organizing software, and I've got to update this because for years I was using Picasa and it is no longer used anymore. Try to get them to tell you in advance, or if it's your system, record all of that for your family. One of the best ways to keep up with digital preservation is from the Library of Congress, this digitalpreservation.gov. And so I'll tell you just briefly, it's really pretty easy how you back this up. It's hard to make yourself do it. But the most important thing is have a backup plan. And I can't say it enough different ways, is why I did it like this. You need to have different places to store it. So what's recommended, DVDs are out now, a cloud storage and hard drives. So we have at least 2 external hard drives, and you can get 5 terabytes now for about $120 or so. We have 2 of those that it will back up to, as well as to the cloud, and we use Dropbox for our cloud. It was easy for us, but you can go with Carbonite or any of the others that seem to have a good reputation. As I say, DVDs are really out now and are failing. Here are some more of the recommended ones. So the hard part about it is keeping up with the technology. You can't just put it in this hard drive and set it away for 5 years because it may not play anymore. So you need to copy them, keep them copied, share them with as many people as possible, and try to keep up, because certainly down the road we'll come up with a more permanent method and a way to deal with it. try to have this digital estate plan where you write down everything I told you about, your passwords, your system, your file naming system, and put a printed copy of this. One of my clients keeps it with his will because he says he's sure that's the first place his kids will look. But don't wait till then. Tell your heirs now. Because the problem is our DVDs, our hard drives, our thumb drives here are going to be, and already are, as outdated as 8-track tapes or the wax cylinders. How many of you can play a 5 1/4-inch floppy anymore? You know, we really can't. And even if they're still good, the equipment is obsolete. We're not able to deal with that. So, as I said earlier, those daguerreotypes have an advantage because we can still see them, you know. Negatives. My professor would always say if it's like a Planet of the Apes scenario, the end of the world, if you had a candle and a magnifying glass, you can still see a negative, but you won't be able to see what's on my thumb drive here. So ideally what's best is you do all this backup system, and also this is my futuristic image because the Jetsons take place in 2063. How will the Jetsons see our photographs? The best way is if we print out our favorite images or do those photo books so they can see those. Because it's not guaranteed they will ever have access to any of our digital images. Okay, that's in a nutshell for the digital preservation part. But like I say, I can answer as many questions as you want. If any of you who came in later brought photographs, John can scan them. And I'll take group questions now, and then you can catch me later if you have something more specific. So, and thank you.
Can we start your handouts around?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, take as many of these as you want. I also have a sign-up sheet here for the Indiana album if you want to get on a mailing list, and if you're interested in Indiana Memory, which has thousands and thousands of photographs, you can pick up one of these too. Are there any general questions about preservation or identifying your photographs?
Yes.
What condition is it in now? Is it
bolted? I brought it with me to look at it, but it's, I'm taking it to the courthouse, and they're afraid to run it through the surveyor room now.
Oh, yeah.
1840s? My house started in 1847, and they finished in 1954.
Okay.
And luckily they had the original blueprints.
Yeah. Well, they must be copies of an older drawing. I don't think they had blueprints in the
1840s.
Who was the architect?
I don't know.
I can go look at it. But I think in general for that, you'd have to find some specialist who could scan it. Someone else was asking me about scanning large photographs. You can scan them on a flatbed in pieces and then stitch them together. But something that big, and it might be fragile.
It is.
Yeah. You can photograph it with the camera, or, you know, you can have a sheet-fed scanner. But for storage of it, it's rolled now? Folded? Well, I'll take a look at it then. That's a specialized, I'd have to see it. Any other questions?
I brought some photographs I'd like you to age, and if anybody else has any that they
want to age. I can move back there and start looking at the photographs.
Actually, these are my great grandparents, and these are my immigrants. But I don't know the day they're colors. Well, not very sure. You know, she's prior to the 1890s, I know that. But you know, what I try to do with these is get their birth years.